To convene the March 12, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened.
Morning, Patty.
We've got a pretty good agenda this morning. We have two public hearings, and then we're going to have three work sessions. For those of you who are in on specific bills, my intention is to go right in order as they are listed on the schedule this, or the agenda this morning. And folks who are or maybe here for the Hatchery Research Center, please know that we're anticipating a referral to Ways and Means on that. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing this morning on House Bill 2207. And excuse me, Mr. Gallagher, if you could remind us what that bill's all about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2207 requires vessels with empty ballast tanks to undergo saltwater flushing of empty tanks before a vessel enters waters of the state.
Thank you very much. And this is an exceedingly important issue. And Representative McEwen, I suspect that you may have...
I'd be happy to tee this up if you don't mind.
If you would, please. And if there are any folks that you want to call up with you or whatnot, please feel free.
If I just make an introduction and then our certified smart people.
Sounds great. Sounds great.
All right.
Good morning, and thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm delighted to be here today. As the House representative on a task force that has spent the last number of months dealing with a very important issue to all of us who live on the coast. A task force was formed. We met, I believe, four times. Senator Rowland represented the Senate side, and I was happy to represent on behalf of the House of Representatives. By the way, I'm Catty McEwen,
Thank
House
you.
District 9. I get very excited about these issues. As a former port commissioner, they don't get more important than these types of things. So House District 9 representing the South Coast. And this comes from a lot of work from a very robust group of people, including a number of state agencies, the shipping industry, the port industry, and the legislative branch to come together on a bill that deals with a very significant problem that we want to make sure that we are addressing, and it has to do with the danger of ballast water and the impact that it can have in introducing invasive species into the waters of Oregon, and particularly with this bill, our freshwater ports. And this took a lot of work. A number of people were at the table coming from different points of view, and we all came to consensus that this particular bill dealing with the particular the technology and the issues that our shippers have to go through to do ballast water exchanges, how they do them, the timing of them is something that we need to monitor very carefully, that we need to regulate. And we came up with a bill that everybody agreed on was the next step that we need to take in ensuring that our waters are safe when commercial vessels come in with ballast on board or in no-bobs with no ballast on board, depending on what they're doing with their particular vessel at any particular time, and how we protect ourselves. There are some federal regulations. There are state regulations. There are other states doing different types of things. We're trying to align ourselves very carefully with what our neighboring states are doing so we don't put our shippers at a disadvantage. But we also want to be very aggressive about how we continue to move forward with regulations that protect our very, very precious coastal waters. So what I would like to do is turn this over to the people who are sitting behind me to explain the details of the bill. There will be a companion bill coming that you will see later that's an agency bill coming out of DEQ that would add a fee on our shippers. It's a fee increase that they are very happy to take the burden of so we can make sure that the regulatory side of what we're doing in monitoring these things things are done very, very well and done with an eye towards making sure that we're protecting ourselves for the future. Because once these things get away, it's a tremendous problem. And I'll give you an example. The bay that I represent is Coos Bay, and as a former port commissioner, this is something that I've had an eye to for a very long time. And we have some things in our bay that we don't want there. We don't know how they got there. We'd prefer that they hadn't arrived, but they have. And we have to figure out how we deal with those things. So the more preventative work we can do and the more aggressive we are, the better we're all going to be. So on that note, I will turn this over to the rest of the panel who's going to come up behind me. I believe Mr. Sitzma and Dr. Sitzma. Who do you have?
Good morning.
And Ryan, please come on up.
Please come forward. Thank you very much, Representative. Welcome to each of you this morning.
Thank you.
We're very pleased to have you, and please determine among yourselves the order of your testimonies.
Well, thank you, Chair Witt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Abby Baduras. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm a legislative analyst there. I'm here today with Ryan Huff, a staff expert on ballast water and invasive species, to testify in support of House Bill 2207 today. As Representative McEwen mentioned, the bill is the result of a lot of work by the Task Force on Shipping and Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species, which DEQ facilitates and provides staff support of that. The task force, which was reconvened by the legislature in 2013, includes Representative McEwen, Senator Roblin as legislative advisors, as well as a diverse group of other stakeholders, and I expect you will hear from some of them today. Last year, when 2207 was originally drafted, there were a couple items that were still outstanding, but 2207, as amended by the Dash 3 amendment, it's actually the Dash 3, I believe, is what is in front of you today.
Yes, correct.
Thank you. Represents consensus. The Dash 1 and Dash 2 are encompassed either. Dash 3 includes it all, and a couple of things were actually amended right out of the original bill. So the bill with the Dash 3, full consensus.
Thank you.
It is one of two bills in front of the legislature, as Representative McEwen mentioned, about ballast water. Senate Bill 261 increases the per-vessel ballast water fee in order to sustain our current service levels at DEQ of the ballast water program. It has passed the Senate, and it is actually on the way to the Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee next. And now I will turn it over to Ryan to provide background on ballast water management efforts in Oregon and the substantive elements of 2207. Ryan?
Thank you, Abby. Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Huff from the Department of Environmental Quality. As our state's ballast water program coordinator, I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2207. DEQ's ballast water program is rooted in a prevention-first philosophy, recognizing that incidental discharges from commercial vessel activities are a major threat for transporting aquatic invasive species, and that the cost to manage these nuisance species after they become established can be very high. Over 60 aquatic non-indigenous species have been introduced to our state's largest harbors, some of which are shown in the images on the left here. Critters including crabs, snails, copepods, amphipods, and prawns, all of which were likely introduced via ballast water discharge. We in the Pacific Northwest are fortunate that these non-indigenous species have generally not resulted in the headline-grabbing environmental devastation that has affected many other regions throughout the world. But we do not have to look far from our borders for the examples of the types of invasive species consequences that we are trying to prevent with these regulations. San Francisco Bay and the Great Lakes both have become home to hundreds of non-indigenous species, some of which have fundamentally altered ecological processes and contributed to major declines in commercial and recreational fisheries. Perhaps most startling has been the more than $100 million per year in expenses to industrial and municipal water conveyance systems in the Great Lakes that have resulted from the invasion of the quagga and zebra mussels to that region. These species have subsequently been spreading throughout other areas of North America over the past 25 years. The quagga zebra mussel invasion in the Great Lakes was the wake-up call that led to the development of ballast water management strategies for commercial vessels by various jurisdictions over the last two decades. The predominant management strategy has been mid-ocean ballast water exchange, where a vessel operator is required to empty their tanks of ballast originally sourced from a foreign coastal harbor and replace it with mid-ocean water. The efficacy of ballast water exchange for protecting our waters is particularly well demonstrated in the slide images on the right, showing the abundance of plankton collections from ballast tanks before and then after a exchange was conducted. Ballast exchange can be highly effective at disrupting the potential for a match between the source environment and the receiving environment. This is particularly true for harbors like those common to Oregon, because the high salinity mid-ocean water acts as an osmotic shock to kill the types of species that represent a high risk for invasion once released into our low salinity harbors. Oregon ports receive about 12 million cubic meters of discharged ballast water per year. For perspective, that's about 265 million gallons per month, or about 13 Olympic-sized swimming pools per day. Fortunately, since our ballast management laws have been implemented over the past decade, a vast majority of that water, about 84% in 2014, was reported to have undergone a ballast water exchange, as I just described, prior to its discharge, and therefore was not directly transferred from a distant port into our waterways. My main motivation for sharing this graph with you is to point out that due to new federal regulations beginning to be implemented this year, the breakdown of this pie chart is expected to undergo dramatic change in the coming years. Starting this year and over the next 5 to 7 years, we expect the largest slice of this pie graph to slowly decline towards zero, while the smallest slice of this pie graph, the one that's labeled as other, less than 1%, is going to rapidly increase in terms of the proportion. That less than 1% is other management strategies, including the use of ballast water treatment systems. Despite the proven efficacy of ballast water exchange, as I just described, it has been long regarded as an imperfect or stopgap solution that does not provide as much invasive species protection, especially for marine harbors, as it does for freshwater harbors like the Columbia River or, to a certain degree, also Coos Bay. The new federal regulations by the U.S. Coast Guard have established ballast water discharge standards that put a limit on the number of living organisms allowed per unit of discharge. And in most cases, it's going to require the installation and use of shipboard ballast water treatment systems. While our agency continues to be supportive of this development and the goal for further reducing global invasive species transport risks, DEQ and others have identified various concerns about these federal regulations and their ability to protect our local resources. First, many systems being installed are first generation and do not have a verifiable record of reliable long-term use in the marine environment. We're concerned that this transition to a brand new management strategy is likely to be fraught with system failures, and that there are inadequate provisions for alternative management requirements to prevent the discharge of high-risk ballast water to our state. Most importantly, however, we're concerned that the federal authorities have adopted a discharge standard that may not actually reduce the number of high-risk species that could be discharged into Oregon waters, as compared to the current practice of ballast water exchange. At worst, we fear that the implementation of the federal standards in Oregon could, under some limited circumstances, represent a step backwards in our ability to prevent the introduction of invasive species. There are two examples of ways that other jurisdictions have already dealt with these same concerns. California has legislated a state-specific ballast water discharge standard that is roughly 100 times more stringent than the federal standard. In contrast to this California approach, however, the EPA and some other states have endorsed the less stringent Coast Guard discharge standard. However, in recognizing the concern about the protection, the question of protectiveness for freshwater harbors, they have opted to continue to require ballast water exchange in addition to the use of these new shipboard treatment systems for a subset of high-risk vessels. Despite a DEQ recommendation, EPA only adopted this strategy in its National Vessel General Permit for vessels entering the Great Lakes and did not adopt it for all of the nation's low salinity ports. DEQ is committed to continuing to work with our stakeholders to develop consensus-based solutions for these concerns that are feasible and suitable for Oregon's needs. I hope that's provided a sufficient background on the status of ballast water management in Oregon and the emerging issues that we are grappling with. I'd like to now just focus on the specific elements of House Bill 2207 with the Dash 3 amendment. 2207 with the Dash 3 addresses really two things. First, it clarifies EQC authority to adopt by rule standards and procedures for ballast water management that minimizes the risk of invasive species for our state, including the authorized use of ballast water treatment systems and alternative management strategies. EQC authority to adopt these rules and procedures was already established by the 2009 House Bill 2714, which was a bill sponsored by Chair Witt. However, while the legislation clearly established the authority under ORS 783.635, it did not address a potentially related and constraining exemption clause in 783.630. If this authority is clarified, DEQ may propose to the EQC rules involving the two topics that I've identified on this slide. The first, involving saltwater flushing requirements for empty ballast tanks, has already been supported and endorsed by all task force members, and simply would address the concern that empty ballast tanks still contain residual water and sediments that could represent a high risk to our state waters. The second topic would aim to address the concerns over the efficacy of the new Coast Guard regulations that I mentioned earlier. The task force has made great progress on this topic in recent months, as Representative McEwen mentioned, and we've realized that achieving full task force consensus on this issue will require greater coordination with a variety of stakeholders, including our neighboring states. And this is something that could be more readily achievable via coordinated rulemaking efforts. If DEQ pursues rules on this issue, we will continue to work with our task force members as a rulemaking stakeholder advisory group to identify solutions that are both practical and adequately protective of our environment. Lastly, as introduced under the Dash 2 amendment, House Bill 2207 would distribute penalties collected on behalf of ballast water management violations and distribute them to the state's invasive species control account rather than to the general fund. This account is held by the Department of Agriculture, and the account is administered by the Oregon Invasive Species Council for purposes solely related to the control and eradication of newly discovered invasive species in state's waters, or rather within the state entirely, not just aquatic-based, but also could be terrestrial. That concludes my prepared comments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill as amended. I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Mark Sitzma. I'm a professor of environmental science at Portland State University, and I chair the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force this year. Representative McEwen is on the task force. He gave a good introduction to the task force activities. Representative Witt has served on the task force in the past, but I've distributed with my testimony a fact sheet that describes the total membership of the committee and the charge that the legislature has provided to the committee. We did produce a report to the legislature this year. Then there is a URL on that fact sheet that I provided that where you can access the full report from the task force. I am happy to report, as Ryan mentioned, that the task force was unanimous in support of the bill with the Dash 3 amendments. My testimony has an error because Dash 2, but they're Dash 3 amendments. It will strengthen the ability of the state to prevent the establishment of aquatic invasive species by requiring better husbandry of these sort of so-called no-bob tanks, ballast onboard tanks that are empty, but they still usually contain residual water and sediment, and that water and sediment could contain organisms if they were discharged into the Columbia River or into other ports in the state, could create problems for us in terms of invasive species. And also, as Ryan mentioned, it diverts fines levied on ships that violate the regulations to the invasive species control account. The invasive species control account was established in 2009 with one-time allocation of funds by the legislature. and it's used to sort of for a rapid response fund for newly discovered invasive species that have a economic and ecological threat to the state. It's the only fund we have for that really rapid response that we need to when we discover some new pioneering infestation of organisms. The task force acknowledged the importance of this control account to the state's ability to respond to these damaging species, and thought that the ballast management violation penalties would be an appropriate source of revenue to fund that account, to replace monies that are expended and to bolster the account. It was originally set up with $350,000, and as I'm sure many of you know, that's not a lot of money for addressing some of these invasive species issues like zebra and quagga mussels that could cost many millions of dollars, but it is sort of the first line of defense. So I'm happy to answer any questions. That concludes my testimony on the bill. I distributed a letter from the Oregon Invasive Species Council chair and vice chair in support of the bill, that section that diverts the fines to the control account, which the Invasive Species Council controls and disperses. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you all very much. Questions or comments? Vice Chair McLean, please.
Well, it sounds like important work. It sounds like an extensive amount of work, and it also sounds like good work. And so it sounds like it's something we absolutely have to get a handle on, and that we're trying to catch up, but we're doing a good job of that. But the question I had, I wrote down, because I'm new to this, all of the different pieces and parts of the puzzle that are working on this. And we had the Ag Department account, we had the Invasive Species Task Force, and we had the council, which I believe are two different groups of folks. I think I've got one list of them on this one that you handed out. But that sounds like an awful lot of folks to coordinate with when there are some pretty big sort of emergency type issues. So I wanted you to kind of catch me up on how does that work? If you've got a massive problem, like I went to Florida with a speech and debate group of students, and they had something called a red bloom or something off the shore, and it sounded like something that needed to be taken care of right away. So if we have, you know, different things that happen like that, how do we get to be nimble and flexible in our response?
You want to address the council's role?
There are several groups. The Invasive Species Council is 17 members, includes agency representatives and industry representatives. It disperses money from the invasive species control account. That's its role. So it's more a coordinating function among the state agencies, and we have rules or sort of standards and procedures for what's required to distribute money from the control account to address an invasive species issue. We've done it twice, once for tunicates in Coos Bay, and once for Japanese beetles at the airport, where there was no funding available. It's an early infestation. We could go in and take care of it. So that's the role of the Invasive Species Council, 17 members. The task force that we're talking about here, the shipping task force, is really focused in on commercial shipping, and Ryan can address that.
Chair Witt, Representative McLean, members of the committee, I fully support those comments, and there is definitely a little bit of overlap between those two groups, but very different functions and very different focus in terms of what issues they're working on.
Okay.
Next will be Vice Chair Krieger, followed by Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the idea of the fines going into the account. How long? It's at the end there, your page on the screen, it said newly discovered. How long has something remained newly discovered?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, there are rules, administrative rules, to help guide the Invasive Species Council in determining how and when, and the parameters for how the money from that control account can be used. They're fairly specific And again, as Professor Sitzma noted in his comments, it's meant to be the first line of defense. So if there is a problem, a new species that becomes such an infestation that long-term control and management costs are an issue, that's not really the role of this control account. The control account is meant to be able to galvanize very quickly without having to go to the emergency board, for example, to be able to bring the appropriate experts and appropriate resources together quickly in case there's an opportunity to eradicate something or to contain it to a very small area. So that's sort of the primary goal and focus of the control account.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've been at some seminars with the National Sportsman's Caucus, and we've talked about these very issues. The quagga and the zebra mussels, by the time you realize that you have them, you probably lost that battle. That's pretty much a fact. The other species that come in, example, Florida is getting overrun now by pythons, I believe. And I believe that there's also a tigerfish down there from Southeast Asia, as well as maybe some piranhas in the Arkansas area. But how do you, I mean, how, once you discover like something like that into your system, how are you going to overcome that? Because if you have quagga and zebra mussels in the system, when you realize it, you probably lost that battle.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I'll take a first shot at that and certainly allow Professor Sitzma to weigh on this since he's got a lot of expertise in this area as well. You're absolutely right that the concern about something like the quagga or zebra mussel getting into a place like the lower Columbia River
fears me to death.
It's a major problem, and the likelihood of being able to control that at that point is very, very low, which is why we focus on prevention. That's why we really want to put our resources and efforts up front so that we don't have to deal with that, or at least try to delay it a long time down the road before something like that happens. There are some noteworthy examples of cases where even something like quagga and zebra mussel, where if they've been discovered in a fairly small or contained water body, small lake, for example, or reservoir, that they have had some success with eradication even, and in some cases being able to control it and limiting its distribution and range expansion to other areas. So there are different levels, I think, of the way we evaluate what options exist, obviously case-specific and species-specific.
Yeah, Representative Witt, Representative Esquivel, I'll just add that this account is not only for aquatic invasive species. Aquatic species are very difficult because water moves around and they have larval forms that are very small and hard to see. But it also applies to other species. It could apply to invasive animals or insects or plants. And there are lots of examples where particularly invasive terrestrial plants in particular have been eradicated with prompt action. So a good case in point in Oregon is Spartina. We have a Spartina response plan. Spartina is an invasive plant that invades estuarine mudflats, basically. And we have a very robust early detection program with surveys. And when we find it, Department of Agriculture has a program. They, you know, the noxious weed program really jumps on that quickly and eradicates it with not very much resources required. So there are, the control account is aimed at things that really require more resources than any state agency has available, sort of as an immediate access.
Representative Esquivel. So this would apply to, example, I didn't realize this until this last year, 2 years ago, that we have feral hogs in Oregon already. Mm. I didn't know that. Mm. But they've been spotted up in Burns area. And, in fact, I've talked to some of the ranchers up there, and they said, yeah, we have those now. So would that apply to this as well?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, we actually have a feral swine management plan in the state that ODF&W implements. They've been around a long time, and they're fairly well established. So ODF&W hasn't come to the council asking for access to these funds. There are very strict sort of rules for what's required to access these funds. Because feral swine are pretty well established and widespread in the state, I think it might, well, I won't prejudge it, but ODF&W could approach the council for funds to implement a feral swine eradication program. the likely success of eradicating feral swine is probably low, so I don't think the council would look upon that. These funds are really aimed at going in and taking care of a problem and eliminating it, not ongoing management. So the feral swine program is, it's going to take millions of dollars to address that program, the feral swine issue in the state, and the chances of complete eradication, particularly down in southwest Oregon where it's very dense vegetation. You can't see the pigs very well. It's unlikely.
Yeah, we live there.
Yeah.
Representative Esquivel, the question is, are you prepared to do your share in eliminating that problem?
I will go out and do my share, Mr. Chair. Okay,
thank you very much.
Because I've never seen one.
Representative Whitsitt, followed by Representative Barreto.
Thank you. When each state has a different standard or requirement for the ballast discharge, how do the shippers know, you know, as they go into a port of each different state? Like you said, California is 1,000 times stricter than the EPA standards or whoever sets the standards federally. And ours is a little different. And so how do the shippers know, and do they prefer certain ports? I mean, does this make a difference on, does a shipper come to your state or not come to your state?
Chair Whitt, Representative Whitsitt, that's a great question, and indeed this has been a major concern of industry stakeholders at the table. Generally speaking, this could affect competitive advantages between different ports. That's been an argument that we've heard many times and something we want to certainly avoid with any regulations we pursue here in the state of Oregon. Usually the vessel operator, they're operating globally. They work with a local shipping agent to make sure that they're familiar with any local regulations and what they need to do to comply with those. And in a case where there might be something like a different discharge standard proposed by California, that creates a lot of concern about whether the treatment system, the shipboard equipment that they've installed can meet the higher standard. Because obviously they can't be installing two different systems to meet different standards depending on where they're going. The footprint for these equipment, this equipment and the engineering involved just precludes that as an option. So we're very cognizant of that concern, and that's why we've been particularly interested in some locally based strategies and solutions that would defer to the uniform federal standard, the Coast Guard standard, but be able to identify strategically high-risk vessels that we could require some additional alternative management practices from, such as basically just continuing to do an exchange in addition to using that federally approved treatment system as a methodology for getting the level of protection that we think is necessary for our local waterways. So those are the types of strategies that we've been drawn to. We think that they're much more practical and feasible, and we're working with our stakeholders to try to find a solution that that meets everybody's needs.
One
please.
Further follow-up. So if you do a mid-ocean dump or exchange, how far from the closest islands do you do this? I assume you have some sort of radius from land on the mid-ocean exchanges.
Yes. Chair Whitt, Representative Whitsitt, the regulations require that a vessel that has sourced their ballast water from outside of our EEZ, foreign waters, that they need to do their exchange at least 200 nautical miles from any land, whereas vessels that have sourced their ballast water from other areas along the west coast, say San Francisco estuary, where they have lots of critters that we don't want to be brought up here, we require them to only have to go out 50 nautical miles in recognition that their normal voyage wouldn't take them 200 nautical miles offshore. So we've deemed the 50-mile mark to be sufficient along our coastline to accomplish what we need them to accomplish through that exchange process.
Right. Could I just follow
please
up one more? I know people that sail ships, if you will, or boats, whatever, I don't know the right term, from our harbors down into San Francisco. You know, that's just something that they do for fun. Mm-hmm. And so what do you do on those sorts of situations where you have private people going back and forth with fairly large boats?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, our regulations do not address vessels less than 300 gross tons that are not equipped with ballast tanks. That said, we have been very interested and concerned about the role that smaller vessels, including recreational vessels, may play in terms of biofouling. So the types of critters that attach to the hull or to other parts of a vessel, and the possibility that these types of vessels could be a pathway for introducing species up and down in different ports up and down the West Coast. And I should say that also applies to the large commercial vessels as well. Biofouling is also a concern of ours. There are a variety of discussions and coordinative efforts between the states to try to identify ways that we could have a coast-wise, uniform, coordinated strategy to address these types of things. But at this point, there are just some very loose general best management practices that are encouraged, but no no real requirements or methodology for enforcing that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barreto's next, followed by Representative McEwen. Representative Gorsuch, you're in the hole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How is this monitored and enforced if they have to do this 200 nautical miles out? I mean, what's the enforcement policy?
Chair Whitsitt, Representative Barreto. Indeed, there are no observers on board like there is for, say, some commercial fisheries operations. What we do is we combine a variety of shipboard record audits in terms of making sure that they're noting that they did certain operations at certain locations. We cross-reference those with their reporting forms that they submit to us. So that's one level of compliance verification, is to make sure at least they're writing it down that they did something, albeit that we weren't there to witness and observe it. From a true compliance verification standpoint, we also take samples of ballast water and we test them for salinity. It's not a highly robust or sophisticated approach towards compliance verification, but we do know that a vessel that says that it has conducted a mid-ocean ballast water exchange should have salinity at least 32 parts per thousand in their ballast tanks. And if we find that they've got ballast water of salinity less than 30, we know we have an issue that we need to explore further. So that's how we go about that.
Please. So would this be done on every vessel that comes into port then?
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, we do not have the resources to inspect and do compliance verification on every vessel. We're a 1.5 FTE program. That resource level has allowed us to inspect about 15% of the vessels that come to Oregon port facilities. And a good majority of those, we do try to do compliance verification down to the sampling level. Sometimes it's just a meet and greet, but that 15% is kind of where we're at right now in terms of inspection effort.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And Representative Barreto just touched on something I was going to touch on, so thank you. Two things. One is the 1.5 FTE. I believe we're inspecting around 10-15% of the vessels that come in the harbors that garner inspection are the Port of Portland, the Port of Coos Bay, and the Port of Newport, I believe. Is that correct? For the commercial vessels?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, most of our effort is focused on the Columbia River, since that's where 97% of the regulated vessels come into. The other 3% are in Coos Bay, and there are some slated proposals for Newport, but at this point in time, they're not receiving any vessels that would be regulated by these regulations.
Thank you. I just wanted to draw attention to the fact that we don't fund this aspect of kind of the regulatory authority that the state has, and when you're inspecting 15% of vessels, we're not doing a very good job. And so this is something that we had conversations about on the task force. And I think it does, you know, it opens that door to risk, particularly for those of us who are in the hinterlands, who it's tough to come down there. And if it's a four-hour trip to inspect vessels that are coming in and out of Coos Bay. So I just wanted to get that on the record. And I wanted to touch on also the lengthy discussions we had in this task force about the issue that Representative Whitsitt brought up about, you know, how we temper what this
legislation can do with the differences between Oregon, Washington, California, and the federal regulations. Because what we didn't want to do is disadvantage our local shippers by setting a standard that was high enough that was going to, in essence, drive traffic across the river to Washington or to a different port in a different state. So we were really cognizant of that. And in fact, there was a proposal to go a step further. Washington has the ability to write some things into rule that we had talked about legislating, and it's become, in essence, a chicken or the egg, who's going to go first. And you will see this going further, I think, in the very, very near future, as the states, particularly to the north of us, begin to inch a little further into a higher level of regulatory scrutiny. So this is a work in progress. But the business of shipping is the business of shipping, and we were very sensitive about how we couch this and not disadvantage the businesses that are occurring in Oregon right now. So that was a part of the conversation that we had. I just wanted to also get that on the record.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back then to the mid-ocean meeting, how comfortable are you that it's truly killing off these various things? What's the study results show on this?
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, for situations where the ballast was sourced from another freshwater or low salinity port, and the plan is to then need to discharge that water eventually in a place like the Columbia River, another low salinity area, we are very confident that mid-ocean exchange, when conducted properly, and I might add, when there's also compliance verification and enforcement presence at the port of call, we're confident that it is very effective at killing off those organisms. An organism that is suited to live in freshwater or low brackish water just is not going to survive in a tank that has high salinity. So again, there's a lot of caveats and sideboards to this, but the research results have also verified the efficacy of this approach.
Representative Gorsuch.
So the state does 10 to 15% monitoring. Does the United States Coast Guard do any of this?
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, the U.S. Coast Guard Port State Control inspects a lot of this in our waters. And ballast water management, according to the federal regulations, is one of many things on their list to inspect for. What we have found over the years is that their inspectors will typically check to ensure that a vessel has submitted a pre-arrival ballast water reporting form. And that's where 99.9% of their inspections stop.
Okay.
The level of detail that we go into in terms of record book audits to look for inconsistencies and for that matter, then actually going to the step of sampling water from ballast tanks is just something that their resources, their mandates to so many different things, right, hasn't allowed for, or they haven't prioritized for.
One last.
Please.
I want to go back to the Columbia River again. How well do we mesh with the state of Washington? Representative McEwen was bringing up some of this, I think, in terms of their efforts versus our efforts, since it's one waterway, two states. How well are we doing in that respect?
Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch, both of our programs, theirs is administered through their Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. They have a stakeholder advisory group that there is some crossover with our task force. We've stayed very coordinated and high degree of communication to ensure that we are moving forward in a coordinated fashion. A lot of what the Dash 3 amendment is about in terms of ensuring clarity of rulemaking authority for the Environmental Quality Commission is to set up a very similar situation between the authorities, between the two agencies, so that we can in the coming year address these concerns about the new federal regulations and hopefully be able to do coordinated rulemaking in step with one another.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Whitson.
I read somewhere that there's a thought that some of the tsunami debris had attached bivalves that ended up over on our coast here, and I was wondering if you can address that at all. Yeah. If that's true, that there was an introduction of one particular species that they believe probably came in on the tsunami debris attached.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, indeed there has been quite an abundance of tsunami debris, that we believe is to be sourced from the Japanese tsunami event in 2011. And many of those debris have had a variety of different species thriving on them. We also have recognized this as a major concern and need for monitoring along our coast for perhaps new detections of new species. I'm not familiar with any reports of anything outside of colonizing the actual debris itself of any natural populations that have shown up for bivalves that were not here prior to the Japanese tsunami debris. The one thing that's come out in the news just in the last couple of weeks relates to a species of a fish that was found first in the hull of a dory boat that was washed over and collected a living fish that appeared to be of East Asia origin. And that was washed up on the Oregon coast. That was a year or two ago. And then just in the last few weeks, some divers, or actually it was crab, commercial crab fishermen, pulled up some pots and actually found in their pots one of these same species of fish. It was one individual. We can't say whether there's a natural population that has established itself or that it was necessarily tied to Japanese tsunami debris. But it certainly, again, raises the red flags of concern about the possibility that this was an event that could have resulted in lots of new introductions. If you want to add to that.
Okay.
Additional questions or comments? Committee members, I think we all realize that these are the folks in front of us on the front line making sure that we don't have devastating infestations, the likes of which, if anyone's seen any of the photos of what the folks in the Great Lakes states are facing, it is absolutely nothing that we want here in this state. I want to thank each and every one of you for your very hard and very good efforts in protecting our state from these kinds of invasions. And I would just ask all the members of the public, particularly the fishing and boating public, to make sure that they check their boats when they're out of state and come back into the state of Oregon. With that, I want to thank you ever so much for your work and your testimony today.
Thank you.
Committee members, we've been discussing a great deal here of recent about invasive species. And before I call up the next witness and before I forget to mention it, we had hearings on Arundo Domex the other day. It certainly caught my attention. And I believe that Representative Frederick has come up with some information that he's undoubtedly going to be sharing with the committee here later on that may verge on the edge of nightmarish. So.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I will be sending to you a number of things, but in particular a group of patents that I've come across that include the use of the insertion of GMO traits into Arundo Donex. One of them deals with the ability for Arundo Donex to be resistant to Roundup, which is one of the And another one deals with the ability for Arundo Donex to be resistant to cold, which. And we're talking about an invasive species, doesn't need any help. But this is a concern. So I'll be sending these patents around to you. As I've got a stack of them here. I've just got about 8 of them right here. But there are about 92 different patents that have been introduced regarding this. And I want to get you to take a look at them.
Thank you.
And we are in part waiting, committee members, before we work that bill for some of the results of Representative Frederick's research so that we can get a full perspective on that. Thank you with that. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Mark Landauer. And is there anyone else in the audience at this point that would like to testify today on House Bill 2207? Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of actually two different groups, the Oregon Public Ports Association, 23 ports in the state of Oregon, as far south as Brookings Harbor up to Astoria, and then, of course, east along the Columbia River to the Port of Umatilla. The other hat I'm wearing today is the Columbia River Steamship Operators Association. Both of our organizations enthusiastically support House Bill 2207 and the Dash 3 amendments. You've had a very good discussion here, and I don't want to belabor it. You've hit on many of the issues our associations are very interested in. Consistency between the states for this single waterway is very important to our shippers, and needless to say, to the many ports that along the Columbia River. I won't belabor this anymore. You had a very good discussion about the subjects that are before you and are contained in this bill. We are very comfortable with the measure, provided you bring the Dash 3 into it, again, to be a little bit flexible, but to maintain that consistency between the two states. And with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anything from the committee? I'm not seeing any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, very much. Appreciate all that support. Last and final call for public testimony on House Bill 2207. Seeing none, hearing none, I'm going to, before I close the hearing again, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I didn't think much about invasive species until I was in a seminar in Alabama. And the one that stuck in my mind the most was the picture of a lake. And this guy, quite innocently, threw his aquarium water in the lake. Didn't think about it. And that little spindly grass that you get in these aquariums,
yeah,
it literally overtook the whole lake to the point where the people couldn't run their boats to their docks. And when you see something like that, I mean, it gets your attention. And then I started looking more at the Great Lakes and what's happening with the zebra mussel there. And then Lake Mead as well has a real problem. So that's when I became very attuned to what we're doing in this, or what we weren't doing in this state, and what we need to do in this state in order to protect the environmental situations with the ecosystem, because it's such a fine balance. And if you get it out of balance, then you have a real, real problem in the state.
Check your boats, folks, if you go out of state.
Check my boat? I don't own a boat.
Representative McEwen, thank you again for bringing this bill forward. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2207, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3197. Chuck, please, if you would.
Now, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3197 establishes the State Fish and Wildlife Commission Nominating Committee, appointed by the governor to assist the governor in appointing members to the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. It creates a five-member committee and stipulates member qualifications.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel, did you want to...
Actually, I did this on behalf of Stan Steele, so I'm going to let him pack the mail on this thing.
Okay, very good.
There's some, I believe that Representative... Krieger had some amendments he was getting drafted that he felt needed to be put in place. I haven't had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Steele because Mr. Steele was too busy the other day.
All right, very good.
I'm putting him on the spit.
Good morning, Chair Witt.
Good morning.
Members, Representative Esquivel. Thank you for putting me on the spot. The reason for this bill came from our constituents. And actually from people up and down the coast, especially specifically the north coast of Oregon. And, you know, we feel that the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission is one of the most dynamic boards, deals with issues from, well, invasive species to management of all of our fish and wildlife species, actually land use to everything. This is an incredible commission. I mean, it has the agenda before it is very encompassing, and it takes incredible people to understand the breadth of those issues, and it takes specific knowledge to have that board or commission function. So the concern was that several years ago, a seat came open in Congressional 1. It's still open in an area that has had extreme controversy over commercial fishing and the type of techniques that we use in that operation versus sports, allocation of a resource. And so the constituents in that area, as well as the rest of the state, have felt that, gosh, we're not even being represented. Our voices on what is probably, once again, one of the most important commissions we have in Oregon, we don't have a representation. It's not like here where we actually get to vote on who's going to come here and actually have participation in an incredible atmosphere of discussion and dialogue. So the concern was real, and it's very palpable. And it's not to say that it was anything other than possibly just overworked executive department staff. We're not sure. But we are sure that the legislative intent of ORS 496-090. And the intent of that statute is quite clear. It sets up guidelines and timelines. And I really want to commend our newly appointed governor on an announcement she made just several days ago on March 10th. I'm going to read it. Oregon's government belongs to the people, and an informed, engaged populace is essential to democracy. Another essential element is trust, and rebuilding that trust starts now. It gave me goosies as a judge on a certain show that I really like watching says, and the reason it did is because that's exactly right. That's what the public wants out of this building and out of its boards and commission, is trust. Because these are trust resources. Natural resources are the public's resources, and we entrusted a panel and our executive and this building to really do the best that they possibly can. Many states have commissions that are over 20 members, a lot of them in 13s and 14s. Most of them do have a governor's selection process. Some of them realize that we had a similar problem, or they had a similar problem that we're now experiencing. With over 300 to 700 in some states, boards and commissions for the governor's executive staff to work, make appointments to, well, I think they could work on that every day and forget the rest of the business of the state. I mean, think about that. Hiring or interviewing 300 to 700, not just individuals, but applicants for all of those different boards. What a daunting task. And one that obviously takes an incredible commitment. But remember, these are public trust boards, specifically the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. So the angst that the public had, whether they're from the conservation community or from the consumptive conservation community, was palpable, once again. So there's been a lot of criticism about this bill, saying this is just a horrible bill, that it's an anger bill. No, 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 no. It's quite the opposite. We have a legislative intent that we need to follow, and it needs to be recognized by those who sit in higher offices than those that are sitting here. That's what we feel this bill does. And it's refreshing to have a governor with her background in conservation education say this is important. So, in closing, that's what prompted the bill. We think it's a good bill. We think it brings a discussion that's extremely important in front of the legislative body. And I would love to hear and have any questions directed. It's been something that has been dear to my heart, and here's why. Not because I was turned down for this position on this board 6 or 7 years ago, but because really what we want is people who are actively engaged, who really want to be on this board. If we have to go out and say, would you like to be an Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commissioner? Well, if we're looking for on-deck hitters and how many pitches are thrown, if they're not seeking this out, then that tells us, are they as engaged as we want? We have some people right now that have been considered and have applied, that are outstanding candidates for that position, and they've been waiting in the wings for nearly 3 years. That's not how we rebuild trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to recognize Representative Gorsuch, followed by Krieger, then McLean.
Well, I just want to say that I fully agree with what you're saying, and I have, it's not a natural resources thing, but I have a similar concern with the TriMet board, mm-hmm. which some people have heard me harp about for a number of, well, this is my third time around now, and it's the same thing, that we have open appointments that sit and sit and sit. And I think you're right. If anything, it's very much an overloaded executive branch office. And so we have a bill that would do something similar in terms of having Metro have some suggestive powers, you know, no mandates. But I think that we need to really consider this, because I don't think the executive branch can do it all by themselves. And I really don't think that it's the executive branch sitting there and holding back. I think they just, there's so many appointments that they just can't get to them all. So anything we can do to speed up that process, I think, would be extremely helpful. So I think you're on the right track, sir.
Chair Witt and Representative Gorsuch, thank you very much. Once again, this isn't a vindictive bill. Mm-hmm. This isn't a partisan bill. This is a bill to make Oregon a better place, and to make sure, in a contentious world of wildlife and conservation management, that we have people seated. There's only seven of them. Only seven. And when you lose one or two, or you allow people to continue on a term well past what we really have term limits that's really built in, that's concerning. So it's interesting to know that Metro is having similar problems. Public engagement. And when you look up definition of board commission, it's public engagement. And have that dialogue and that meaningful dialogue. And truthfully, if anyone says that we're coming at this to try to load a board with one certain perspective, that's just not true. We want what's best for conservation in Oregon, and have the most knowledgeable citizen engagement that we possibly can have in making our policy and decisions on controversial, just as rural general management. So thank you.
Vice Chair Krieger, please.
I'll be careful what I say, Mr. Chair, because I might say something not politically correct. But there are public trust boards, and specifically, I'll just go to the two, Department of Fish and Wildlife and Forestry. Those two boards, since I've been in this building and before, have been manipulated to achieve certain goals that were dear to the governor or some staff person, or maybe mm-hmm. situation we saw regarding energy. The fact that situation you're very familiar with, where John England came off the board, that wasn't, position wasn't replaced. Why didn't he replace him? Because he didn't want a representation on the board when he pulled the stunt on the Columbian River gillnet fishery, which basically the chair of the Wildlife Commission said, you'll get this done or else. We also know that there were three names up to be the new director of Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have our present director in the back, Kurt Melcher. If the governor had not resigned when he did, Kurt Melcher wouldn't be the director. It'd be the lady that was on that board. That was all set to go. That's how much pressure was being put on by the governor's office to put the people they wanted in there to complete their agenda, which was not the public's agenda and was not the agenda of the constituents of those agencies. Landowners, forestry people, hunters and fishers, environmental community. So I think a lot of this manipulation that's going on, regardless of what party it is, needs to stop, and we need to get competent people on those boards that can help us get the job done managing our resources. And I think this bill is the start of it. I do think it has to be amended, but it is definitely needs to happen.
Representative Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we agree. I liken this bill to a child's can of Play-Doh. that we get to plop it out in front and start molding it into something that actually is great to work with. And I think that the conversation that this bill has brought is the most healthy thing that probably could have occurred for our Fish and Wildlife Commission and a lot of our management resources. Possibly I differ from Representative Krieger on one issue here. I'm excited about the governor, our new governor. I think that we have some real opportunities here. And so time will tell. Trust will be built or trust will be repelled. And the public is keenly aware that Oregon's in an incredibly transitional, controversial period. And our eyes and our ears are wide open. You can't continue to have a decline from over 350,000 hunters to 196,000 hunters. You can't have a 17% drop in hunters and an 18% drop in anglers through a recent U.S. Fish and Wildlife study and think that our commissions in the last decade have done a great job at bolstering our resource funding base. As a matter of fact, quite the contrary. Other states have increased and we've decreased. Recent examination, we have evaluations that the commission has to do on themselves. And when I looked at it, it was 100% successful on everything that was they were tasked with. So was their task to lose several hundred thousand hunters? So I think this commission, and I'm hoping that this governor's administration looks at rebooting, understanding that our base, economic base in conservation in Oregon is around our heritage sports. Yesterday I sent some of you a recent study that just came out of Clemson University and Cornell. Now, I don't think those are low-level universities. I think that they're probably pretty well recognized in the scientific world. Hunters, this is an extremely important fact for everyone in the room to remember. Hunters and bird watchers are commingled. A hunter that's a bird watcher is 8 times more apt to be an ardent conservationist than any other population segment in the United States. Think about that. That's what hunters want to see on the commission, is ardent conservationist. That's an incredible study. Everybody said we want the science? There it is. So thank you, Representative Krieger.
Bulls to butterflies.
Bulls to butterflies. Thank you, Representative Witt. Fenner's Blues.
That's correct. I'm going to recognize here in just a moment Vice Chair McLean, Esquivel on deck, Whitsitt in the hole. Before I do, I just want to state, Vice Chair Krieger, that as you well know, I have shared a number of your frustrations over a good number of years now. And I am encouraged by what I have seen and heard coming out of the governor's office of recent.
I agree very much so.
And the attempt to open the lines of communication has been exceedingly encouraging. As early as 7:30 this morning in my office, I have to tell you that that makes a point to me. I would also note that Governor Brown is someone who on occasion likes to throw on a pair of hip boots and go duck hunting. And I think she's been known to wet a line from time to time. And I'm not so sure, but what it helps to have folks who not only appreciate the state, but appreciate its wildlife and partake in hunting and fishing to help maybe change some of the frustrations that a number of us have been experiencing. So,
Chair Witt, that is so exciting, and here's why. We look at the western states, and Representative Esquivel a few minutes ago discuss the congressional sportsman's caucus or the Oregon Legislative Sportsman's Caucus. We also have a congressional governor's caucus. We've made requests out of several governors to join that caucus because it's really great, and we saw that in Bend when legislators from throughout the United States get together and talk about common issues and common problems. And to not be a participant means that, well, either you're not feeling those problems are significant or they're just, you know, just not important enough to get involved in. So I know the governor's not here, but I'm sure going to extend the invitation to her to join the Congressional Governor's Sportsman's Caucus, because if she puts on a pair of hip boots, whether it's to hunt or to fish, well, she's my kind of lady.
There we go. Mm-hmm. With that, I'm going to call on, please, Vice Chair McLean.
Thank you very much. Mr. Steele, I appreciate the dialogue today, and I believe that everybody I've met since I've been in the building this session are people who care passionately about public engagement, and people in this room are really passionate about the natural environment and managing it and utilizing it and enjoying it. So I think that, you know, I would feel that everybody in this room wants your goal to succeed, and that is make Oregon and public engagement better. But the one thing that I feel like I've learned, and, you know, as I go on in this journey of life, is that it doesn't matter who's in these chairs, doesn't matter, you know, who the governor is at any given time or who's in the legislature, it matters about the process being pristine enough that it's going to actually work no matter who's in the chairs. And so for me, when I'm looking at this, I'm always looking is, can the goal be met with the structure that's being suggested? And so, you know, in my experience, and I guess to, you know, provide you with a question, not just an editorial, I've never seen when another committee or another public body or another, you know, board to advise, to, you know, set a board necessarily is a structure that I would choose. Because, again, it means just like in the first item that we were talking about, when you have, you know, overlapping committees or overlapping boards, or you have two or three different boards that have to all come to conclusion, it doesn't necessarily help you with your 3-year hole because you didn't have someone, you know, seated, because you had somebody else who had to get involved in the conversation. And so I guess my feeling is it really the other board you want, or is it really that we need to really look at the criteria and we really need to look at what is provided to whoever is going to do the appointments?
Chair Witt, or Vice Chair McLean, excellent questions. I look at this nominating committee very similar to a search committee that we use basically in our city governments and our county governments, our school boards, just many levels of government, to where we actually have a search committee identify the very best people. And those will then go to a city council or to the county commissioners for final interviews. Eugene's going through it right now for their superintendent of instruction. One of their people just backed out. And so I understand, could this be another level of what we would classify as bureaucracy? Well, of course it can be. There's no question. Most of us want to see simple government, and we're adding another layer. But if that layer provides us a benefit that is so far-reaching, and we get rid of Representative Krieger's and mine and others' concerns about the cloak of darkness, this backroom smoky deal, then everybody's better. The transparency is one of the key issues I wanted to see driven in this and what our constituents wanted. And I'll give you an example. The last commissioner, the three, we were called an hour by the governor's staff, an hour or so before those people were to go before Senate confirmation. We sat in this very room, this very hearing room, and got to ask a few questions. That's how the public vetting went on three commissioners. We had no idea their background. We had no idea whether they've ever bought a license or whether they are anti-hunting or pro-hunting or whether they're, what their political stance was or what their actual personal knowledge was. And the statute's clear. They have to have considerable knowledge.
And why should a commercial fisherman be excluded because he's a commercial fisherman? I want a commercial fisherman on those panels because we deal with commercial fishing regulations. So I hope that wasn't too long an answer, but I really think that, well, an example, I sat on a selection committee for a high school baseball coach a number of years ago, and we interviewed a lot of people, and then that went to the AD. So this is what we're doing, is we're interviewing our Fish and Wildlife Management coaches.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was 2 years ago, 4 years ago, can't remember, time goes by when you're having fun, but I introduced a bill that would have required a number of the commissioners to at least possess and have an active license for 5 years prior to being put on. And it wasn't all of them. It was just a certain amount of them. I think it was five or four or something like that. But we had a lot of opposition from the environmental community for some reason. I don't know, but I do know that we have some very talented people that have been promised by our previous governor positions on that commission, and then when those openings came up, they bypassed that individual and went to a political appointment. And the political appointment wasn't necessarily who I would ever have picked. So I think this is a check and balance we need to do. Yeah, we say, okay, but the Senate has to confirm this. Well, trust me, folks, I was in the Senate. I know how they confirm this. Well, you got Joe and so-and-so and so-and-so. Very seldom do we get to really vet these people out and find out what they are. We just don't know how they're going to be on it. We don't have much of a background, really, on it other than what you read. And, you know, I can write a pretty good resume. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm qualified for the job. So I would strongly suggest that we take a very good hard look at this, and if we have to amend it slightly, do some amendments, I think that's fine. But I think the basis of it is just like Stan said, it's just the bunch of clay that we're making now and molding it into something that we can use.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up about the politicalness of this, of the appointments. Wyoming, for example, I think most of you have listened to me testify enough now that you know that I'm a research-driven guy. I want to make sure that when we come in, we actually have points that we can refer to. But Wyoming, for example, does not allow, and they on their board, they do not allow more than four of their commissioners to be from the same political party. And what they're trying to do there is get a,
That's a good idea.
Nonpartisan commission. Because many times, do you think a duck that hopefully Governor Brown gets to hunt cares whether it's a D or an R? When he's flying over
from Oregon.
Well, an Oregon duck. Okay.
Maybe I good point.
Good point. Why should you use something different?
But that's great. I just don't think that's the way we should be deciding what's best for Oregon, Oregonians, and Oregon wildlife. I think there's some issues that we actually can separate the politics out of and be better for.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
And that reminds me of, I'm on the Executive Council nationwide for the National Sportsman's Caucus. And our president, Robin Webb, from Kentucky, after 4 years, she finally told me that she was a Democrat. And I had no idea because no one cared. What that amounts to is, do we have a common interest? And I think this committee's the same way. You park the political stuff at the door and you walk in and you do the business and what you feel is right. And that was amazing to me that she finally just told me, and I never asked because I didn't care. But it's amazing that how many Republicans and Democrats are involved in that, and yet no one knows what their affiliation is whatsoever.
Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I agree with this bill, and I do have some personal experience, but not with Fish and Wildlife. But a number of years ago, not the last governor, but a governor previous, I really wanted to sit on the Board of Geologic Examiners, and that's a little bit more than the commissions in as much as they oversee licensing and this sort of thing. And I... We put my name in. There was a vacancy. We waited, and I just could not figure out what was wrong. And then someone came to me and said, you know, you need someone from the other party. And, you know, I wasn't a legislator or anything, but you need someone from the other party to carry your name forward in order to be considered for this. So there's someone who's still in this building from the other party who was kind enough to do that and spoke for me, and then suddenly it happened. But at the same time that this vacancy sat open, there were people on the board who didn't have a background, because the boards and commissions often have people who don't have a background, and why, I don't know. I mean, I've never understood this. If you're going to make decisions on something, you should have some sort of background in it, like you're talking about for hunting licenses or whatever. So I ended up eventually being appointed, only to find out that because I was an employee of the legislature, I could not serve because it's a dual, you know, you can't work for the executive branch and the administrative branch at the same time. But the point being, there are all kinds of boards and commissions in the state that would be well served by a number of people waiting off in the sidelines who are not, you know, being brought forward until you get the right political person to bring your name forward, which is just does not seem right at all. You know, so the positions go wanting. And so I think it's not only a good bill for fish and wildlife, but I'd like to see it as a statewide policy, which won't happen now, but it's definitely something good.
Chair Witt, yep. Representative Whitsitt, you know, what you just said was, what a great OJT for people moving into your chairs or people moving into our executive branch chairs. These are people who are testing the waters. They're just putting their toes in the waters in public engagement, in public office. And, you know, it's interesting. One state has a requirement that one of their 13 members has to be over 60 years of age. And, you know, so you see all kinds of different requirements written into the commissioners. But I think you're on to something there. I really look at this as a person who's working for what we classify as a highly engaged conservation organization in the Outdoor Council. One of the hardest things we have is recruiting our leaders. We have a lot of followers, but our leaders. So when someone steps forward and said, I want to do that, I want to help Oregon make those decisions, well, that's a budding leader. And, you know, I would love to see in our governor's office what we apparently might have, someone who understands conservation and is a participant. And at that point, all of our jobs, whether it's protection of a species or utilization, because truthfully, that's what conservation is, becomes easier. So, great point. Thank you for your comments.
Additional questions or comments?
Yes, one really quick. Stan, I want to go back to one thing you just said, conservation. And it's something I think I've already harped about, but we in this state seem to have gotten away from the idea that conservation means both things. It means wise use as well as protection. And I think too often, especially in the more urban areas, we think that conservation means freeze it all. And so the more people we can have on these boards that understand that it is both things, the better off we'll be, I think.
Chair, Representative Gorsuch, my gosh, the term, the definition, conservation, it's age old. You can look it up in many different textbooks or many different dictionaries. Conservation is absolutely the wise utilization and preservation of our natural resources. That is conservation. When we lock things up, it's preservation. We can't co-opt the term. We need to tell it like it is, because truthfully, the study at Cornell and Clemson just told who your number one conservationists were, and conservation is what we should be striving for. But we will protect more species through conservation than any other activity.
And that goes back to the original head of the U.S. Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot, who was very much a conservationist.
For the greater good.
Yes. Gifford Pinchot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
and a man who had a really tough go at times bucking his superiors. Yes. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Witt. This is a. I am enjoying the conversation that's taking place here for a number of reasons, because what I hope that it manages to do is to dissuade us from the confrontational adversarial approach that we have seen. I have grown up in a community that has both a great deal of conservation folks, environmental folks, who do not see themselves as preservationists. But that term is used in a way to create that adversarial relationship rather than approach it as how people are actually looking at things. They'd like to see us continue. So I just encourage us to use the language carefully. We have a number of people who are very strict conservationists. As you said, many of them are hunters, but many of them are also at the heads of conservation groups that get more than a little annoyed by being portrayed as only wanting to preserve things and not wanting to work with people. So I think it's good to see this kind of conversation take place. I want to make sure that we actually show the respect for those views that those folks, that other folks have as well, because I'm curious to see how this particular group might be formed. I've watched on another level. I've watched the previous governor change the complexion of the boards and commissions in the state of Oregon. At one time, there were only 12 African Americans on all of the 250 boards and commissions in the state of Oregon. There are now more than 100. That has come about because of a direct effort on the part of the small staff that they have to put together people who can be submitted as members of boards and commissions. And so we have someone on the Fish and Wildlife Board, and we have someone on other boards that were not the social service boards. Or what happened was the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs had 8 of the 12 at one time. So that didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So we now have folks on all sorts of boards and commissions. It's difficult. And this goes back to something that we actually started talking about earlier, with the capacity. We have taken apart the capacity for some of our agencies to actually be able to be effective, and get those people there, both in terms of appointments as well as inspections of ballast water, and these are issues that I think we need to look at on a long term. If we want to have certain things done, we need to have the resources to do them, and that it doesn't come by just wishing that might be the case. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. It's going to be interesting to see how far it goes. Thank you.
Representative Witt, Chair Witt, Representative Frederick, excellent comments. And I want to personally thank you for your involvement in the last several weeks on some contentious fish and wildlife management issues, because that's the leadership that it has to be given. And I call that the political courage to make tough decisions. We can all tuck and run and hide. That's simple. But it doesn't move the dial. It causes a lot of consternation in our communities and angst. So what's so great about this committee is this is probably the most highly functional committee in the building for the public to engage. And that is absolutely crucial to have the dialogue that can overcome the confrontational lifestyles and just our ideologies. There's a gentleman sitting in the back of the room, I believe still here, Scott Beckstead, who has a completely different ideology on many of the issues than what I do. But you know what? We're getting to know each other. I would actually say we're becoming friends. He bought coffee, I bought donuts the other morning. And that's how we're going to get to the common ground on many of these controversial issues. So I appreciate your comments, because if we don't get past those, solutions will never be found.
Just for the record, we'll note it's the ex-cop that bought the donuts.
That's what I was going to say.
Just way too easy, you know?
Stan, I like donuts, too. Don't feel bad.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm there with you.
Anything further for Stan this morning?
Isn't that profiling?
Yes.
It is. It's reverse profiling.
Stan, thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you all.
Truly
so
appreciate everything that you do and the hours and hours and hours of time that you give. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Lori Annan. Lori, welcome to our committee and good morning.
Thank you and good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Annan. I'm with the Office of Governor Kate Brown. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'm glad to have heard the testimony and spoken with some folks on this issue before the hearing today. It's a new issue to me. I've been with the governor's office since December 2014, and I'm working on natural resources issues. And so I'm just going to say a few words here today, because I appreciate all of your comments. You recognize that Oregon's citizen boards and commissions are part of what makes Oregon special. And I really appreciate the thought you're putting into this discussion. The governor's office has been doing a lot of work recently on the Fish and Wildlife Commission appointments. We know they need to happen. There is a lot of interest from a lot of people willing to serve. We expect to advance two nominees to the Senate to consider in April this year. And I want to make sure I bring what I've heard today to Governor Brown's attention, and that there's that she hears the folks' concerns. And certainly, if there's other folks that I haven't heard from today, please let me know and talk to me. And that's really what I wanted to say this morning. And be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you.
Questions or comments?
Just a comment, maybe.
Please.
I think everybody is very eager to engage with the governor and help her be successful as our governor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And committee members, it was, in fact, Lori who showed up in my office at 7:30 this morning, and I told her privately. I will state it publicly. It was refreshing, and I very much appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
And it's so nice to meet you, and thank you for your note the other day regarding the issue that came up. I appreciated it very much.
Oh, well, thank you, and I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to call up next, please, Tom Wolfe, Jim Myron, bear with me just a second here, and Mike Salvaggio. Mike
must be outside the door.
Okay.
Yeah, he was back there.
Yeah. Stan, if you'd... Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. I'll go first. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolfe, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I submitted via written testimony on OLIS, so hopefully you've had a chance to written. So I'm not going to rehash that, but I just want to share a few things about this issue. As I have been testifying before the ODFW Commission since 24 years. Since that time, there have been 52 different commissioners, 7 ODFW directors. I have testified 312 times, more than anybody else during that period before the commission. And I've seen some great commissioners, some very sincere, good people. So I think that the way that they've done it in the past has worked. But I certainly understand the understanding, the frustration that Stan and others have felt, because for 2 years we've had an open seat on the ODFW Commission. So maybe something needs to be done. I do have concerns about the bill. I do have concerns about the makeup of the committee. It's too slanted towards industry and hunting, and maybe, you know, if you're going to move forward on this bill, we need to look at the makeup. But, you know, something that's lost is the idea that conservation groups only want to lock things up. We went through a mission statement and recognized years ago that there's a difference between conservation and preservation. And Trout Unlimited decided we are a conservation group. We don't want to lock things up. Our members are hunters and fishers. We want to be able to use the resources. And I get a little angry when some people tend to lock us into stereotypes. I hate stereotypes. I mean, for goodness sake, I'm an ordained minister working on fish and wildlife issues. I was Republican for 15 years, you know, so don't lock me into stereotypes. And don't, I agree this issue needs to be resolved. This issue needs to be worked on. And if this committee, in their wisdom, decides that there needs to be a nominating committee, then let's make it one that's fair and right, and let's solve this issue in a way that will continue to make the ODFW Commission the body that decides on how to protect our fish and wildlife, provide opportunities for people to enjoy them, and ensure that future Oregonians can have the resources we have now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio speaking on behalf of the Audubon Society of Portland and its 15,000 members. I'd just like to point out the testimony that Bob Salinger submitted, which is on OLIS. And so as not to repeat itself in the interest of time, I'll just be relatively brief. We'd like to express strong opposition to 3197. We are concerned that such a committee formed would be heavily weighted to a narrow strip of interests with only a single seat reserved to represent conservation and the general public. The committee replaces a system that's been used for appointments at ODFNW, as well as dozens of other state commissions for a long time, which we don't see a particular problem with at this point. We believe that it would add unnecessary layers of bureaucracy and expense to the selection of commissioners while simultaneously reducing the transparency and accessibility of the process. Currently, anyone can forward their name to the governor's office for consideration. Currently, any group of people, citizens, interest groups, can get together and forward suggestions of names to the governor's office. formalizing this process in statute puts a focus on constituencies that may make it more difficult for ODFNW to branch out in terms of its revenue sources. ODFNW is facing significant funding shortfalls, and the challenge right now is to generate new and diversified revenue streams to connect with a much broader and more diverse audience beyond its traditional constituencies, and we see this as an impediment to that. I'll leave you with that, and the rest of that testimony is available for you to read at your leisure.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Jim Myron. I'm representing Native Fish Society. You also have a one-page statement in opposition to the bill on OLIS. Let me just say that we support the current open public process. It provides an opportunity for anybody that has an interest in being on any of these boards and commissions, the 200 and some that the governor has responsibility for putting people on. I could apply to be a member of the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Confirmation might be a bit of a problem, but other than that, the open public process now is what we prefer. And from a practical standpoint, I spent 3 years doing Lori's job. I know how difficult it is to try and find people and get people onto this commission. if you'd have to have a 50-member commission if you gave a seat to everybody that's got an interest in this agency. Fortunately, we don't have to do that because the statute dictates that all of these people have to represent the public interest in the resource. So they're not appointed to represent any particular group or user group or ideology, even though they're appointed by congressional district. They're not there to represent the people in that district. They're not elected officials like you are. So they're there for the public interest. And we just, you know, I can't make any excuses for why the governor hasn't filled that seat for 3 years. That is unacceptable. And I'm not going to try and make any excuses for that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from this panel?
Comment, but I don't, you know, not directed at the panel, but sure. I'd like everyone to think about this. We have a declining Rocky Mountain elk and Roosevelt elk herds in numbers. We have declining mule deer and black-tailed deer, declining in numbers. We have declining pheasant population. We have a declining band-tail pigeon population. How's it working? Just want you to think about it.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Gorsuch, please.
Yeah, I want to respond back to what you were saying before. Labels are a problem. And just because you're in, like Trout Unlimited or your organization, that doesn't mean that your preservation. I think you're right that it means conservation. My comments were about a certain segment that would just like to shut it all down. So I hope you don't think that I was thinking that you all were, you know, somehow intransigent and not interested in working. But there are certain segments that I think are, and that's what we have to get past, I think.
Yeah, Chair Witt, Representative Gorsuch. Actually, when I made that comment, I was being supportive of what you said earlier.
Okay.
I absolutely agree with you. I think we have to get past that. I think we can't. We have to work together. You know,
yeah.
And just for light, I think Stan Steele is a great guy, and I love working with him. And you know, I worry about my gas tank sometimes, but. But he's a great guy, and hopefully we can work together in the future.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I hadn't gone astray somewhere.
No, thank you very much. Anything else from the committee? Gentlemen, we had testimony earlier that this committee would not possibly be unlike search committees that local levels of government go through when they're trying to fill a position. And the specific bill aside, could there possibly be merit in taking a look at that in terms of trying to fill some of these spots? And I forget the specifics of the bill at this point.
Chair Witt, I guess the quick answer to that is, you know, considering my concerns, but I'd say yes. I speak from 24 years of working with the commission. Of course, there are ways we can look at this. So, I get a little. I'm not quite sure if I would support all the concepts of the bill, but I think it definitely deserves a look.
Thank you. All right, Representative Gorsuch. Please.
And if thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might suggest something, and again, I don't know if my bill with TriMet's going to go, but the one thing you might consider is that our bill is designed to be solely advisory. So you have a group of people that come together, and then actually through us, it'd be the Metro Council, and then they make recommendations to the governor. But there's no binding requirement or authorization by the group. So it may be something to consider here.
Think he is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you very, very much. Would you
Would any of you be willing to perhaps meet possibly with Representative Esquivel and see if there were any portions of this that might merit further exploration?
Chair Witt, I'd be happy to. So I think, you know, I'd be happy to talk about this because I think there are sections of this bill that do have some merit. You know, my concerns notwithstanding, but my concerns in 455 will buy a coffee mocha at Starbucks, and sometimes that's all it's worth. But I'd be happy to meet and talk about that because I think there are merits to this bill.
Okay, thank you.
I'd be happy to extend that invitation as well.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Myron again. To me, this seems to be an issue for the governor's office. If the governor has the authority to appoint any kind of advisory committee that she wants as far as advising her on who should be on boards and commissions. And I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense to single out just ODFW. If this is a problem, then let's address it globally. But, you know, why not give the governor a chance to fix the problem internally if it is a problem?
So. Okay. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate your appearance and your testimony. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Larry Soa, Al Elkins, and Joe Rolater. And since I need to try and work three bills, gentlemen, if you could summarize your statements, I would be greatly appreciative. I'm going to try and get three bills out of this committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We are concerned, the board is concerned about the open seats. You've heard that this morning. We are, too. I have an amendment that's being drafted through Representative Esquivel's office that addresses the not the nominating portion, but the end portion where we would be allowed a 30-day window to sit down and talk with those that have been nominated before they go to the Senate confirmation. That's extremely important for the people that I represent, that they get a chance to have a dialogue with the candidate so they know who he or she is and where they are on some of our issues. So that is in LC, it's my understanding, and we would like to bring that forward to the work group and talk about that concept. I will address Representative McLean's concerns about the process with her after the hearing.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Thank you. My name is Larry Soa, Oregon City, Oregon. I served on this committee in the late 80s, but today I'm going to talk to you about what happened before that time. During the Schwab administration, there was a conflict, much like you're seeing now, where Ellen Kelly and Lisa Bateman terms were up. And so a group of us came forward and interviewed the candidates and made a recommendation that the governor reappoint those two people. And that happened. And we did the same thing during the next three governorships. We stayed together and we pretty much interviewed people. And we made sure that all the candidates had a good conservation ethic, knowledge of fish and wildlife issues, ability to work with each other on the commission, and ability to, which I think was important, and at least in that time, was ability to make a motion. Sometimes people vary from staff presentations, and it was really hard sometimes to get that through there. So we worked not only with the Fish and Wildlife Commission appointments, but we worked with the Marine Board appointments, Guides and Packers Board, and a little-known committee called the Deschutes River Management Committee, which we got several members on that. But So I think if we all work together, either to directions from this committee or from passing a bill, we can make sure that things that happened in the last 3 years don't continue. I'm very confident working with the governor when I was in the legislature. She's very competent, and I think she'll solve these problems. But as we go down the road, they may crop up again. And so we need to figure out a process where it's a voluntary committee of all the people that represent the various groups that come here and talk to you. If they can't get together, you may have to give the governor ability to appoint some kind of a nominating committee. But it's very important that we select good people and get them on those boards and commissions when the time of the previous person is up, and not have those vacant things position opens. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I've been around the edges of this process of Natural Resource Management Commissions for 45 years, I suppose. I didn't know that during that period of time when there were commissioners that I really liked a lot, that I thought were great leaders, were vetted in that way. I'd like to read from the bill, Section 2, page 7, the purpose of the nominating committee is to assist the governor in appointing members to the Fish and Wildlife Commission. I think that's the crux of this bill. I took an amendment down yesterday on behalf of Representative Krieger to take some of the restrictive language in the center of page 2 out, and that with amendment that Representative Esquivel appointed. I think there's some things we could do, or we could simply let it lie, and I have full confidence in the new governor. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony. Questions or comments? I'm seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. Representative Esquivel, if you would be willing to head up the work group of anybody that wants to include language changes or whatnot, if you'd take that on, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd also like to have the governor's office involved in that, and we'll be in touch with people, and we'll probably have something hopefully by next week.
Okay, very good. One more person, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association and the Oregon Seed Council. Very briefly, and we support the concept of the bill, but I'd be happy to help on a work group. But if we're going to go down this road, this bill has one member from ranchers of cattle or other livestock. Most of the habitat for wildlife in this state is provided by private landowners and not just ranchers of livestock and cattle. So I'm here to represent the rest of the private landowners, the grass seed producers, the small woodland owners, and I was also asked to mention OFIC members. We are very interested in this concept, but we'd like to be included in the work group also.
Fantastic. Love to have you. Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel, please feel free to call upon whoever you feel is appropriate to help you get that task done.
We'll get a balance.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3197, and I'm going to very quickly open a work session on House Bill 3012. Mr. Gallagher, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3012 establishes the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Fund.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to call on Vice Chair Krieger to please tell us about the Dash 3 amendment, at least conceptually here, so that we all kind of know where we're at on this bill before we vote on it.
You're talking about 12, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There were some concerns in the bill, and I haven't got it all right here in front of me now, but we tried to address those in that there was one concern about whether or not the, get down to lines 15, 16, the surplus funds at the end of the biennium that would go into the hatchery replacement account were dedicated to new hatchery construction. And we changed that around so that it was for maintenance and new construction, but not in additional to, the concern was we were going to have more hatcheries than the 10 coastal hatcheries, so we want to make sure that we got that done. So upgrade, replace current coastal hatchery facilities. And I'm trying to think what the other main, in line 15, that the research was to be carried out by the Oregon at the Hatchery Research Center. Some of the Hatchery Research Center work won't be done by the Hatchery Center at that location, so we just deleted part of that in line 15 in the dash ones, but I think they are included in the dash three. Is it dash threes?
Yes.
Yes.
Excuse me. No, that would
we don't
be,
have a
that would be the dash one. That would be the dash one. Excuse me, I'm in the wrong bill.
That's right.
I have a dash three.
Okay, so committee members, that's the essence of at least conceptually the dash one amendment on 3012. This will not be the last go at this bill because it has received a fiscal, and while it's fiscal light, it nonetheless has to be sent down to Ways and Means. So ours are not the last eyes on this, but I wanted everyone to at least be familiar with that specific amendment, and I'm assuming that it may be your desires to send it on with the amendment. Is there any discussion or questions before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger?
I just have one quick comment.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. We were talking about this yesterday, and you know, the importance of this can't be understated. You know, we have research in a lot of other areas of natural resources, like forestry, for instance, and so it's extremely important that we do everything we can to investigate fisheries, and especially, you know, find the best practices for salmon, steelhead, trout. So it seems to me that funding this is an extremely important. Important to the project.
That's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. I've got Representative Krieger going crazy here, so I apologize, Vice Chair Krieger. I'm going to recognize you for a motion on House Bill 3012.
Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 3012, dated 2/2015.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 3012, dated February 20th, 2015. Is there any discussion on his motion? Seeing none, hearing none. Is there any objection to his motion? I see and hear none on that. The amendment is adopted. Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. Yes. So with that, I'm going to once again recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, would I move House Bill 3212 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation as it be referred to the House Committee on Ways and Means?
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3012 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moreno.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Forster.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
Aye.
Chair Witts.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. And so with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3012. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3013. Okay, Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us about that bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3013 allows establishment of wildlife food plots on small tract forest land subject to reforestation requirements without affecting small tract forest land assessment. There were two initial amendments to the bill, the dash one and the dash two, and that's both of those have been incorporated for simplicity into the dash three amendment that's before us.
Thank you very much. And Vice Chair Krieger, can you tell us very briefly about the dash three amendment?
Unknown to us, and Roger Beyer back there happened to note that the definition we used of small woodland owner didn't include all of the small woodland owners, only ones that paid a certain tax. We changed that so it includes everybody would have access to that pretty much in the small woodland category. The other consideration that we wanted to have is that there be a notice to the state forester that the established food plots didn't remain in just one spot. They could move across the landscape over time, and that notification would have to be given to the state forester.
Okay, thank you very much. Before I recognize Vice Chair Krieger's motion, is there any discussion or questions about either the bill or the amendment? Seeing none, recognize Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair, would I move to adopt the House Bill 3013-3 amendments dated 3-10-15?
Very good. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3013 dated, wow, look at this, 3-10-15, March 10th, 2015. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any objection? Again, seeing none, so adopted. Vice Chair Krieger, again, please, sir.
I move House Bill 3013 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 3013 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Yes.
Representative Esquel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodsett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. Vice Chair Krieger, is this a bill that you would like to carry to the floor?
I would.
He definitely would. He's assigned the carrier. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3013. And I am, folks, because of the hour, going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2453 to a future date to be announced. Is there, and with that, well, I guess I have to open the work session on 2453 in order to announce that I'm going to carry it over. Can we do this quickly? Is everybody okay? Do we have? All right. All right. I'm going to open the work session on 2453. Recognize Mr. Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2453 requires organizers to obtain a permit from the State Forestry Department prior to conducting large commercial events on state forest land and authorizes the creation of rules, permit fees, monitoring, and enforcement provision penalties. And if I may, I'll just simply summarize. We did a work session on this last week, and at the last moment, we accepted an amendment for concern that hunting camps perhaps would be impacted by this. So the dash two amendment simply changes the number that triggers a permit requirement from 20 to 35.
Thank you very much. And that would be one heck of a large hunting group.
I'd like to see that again.
I don't want to cook at that camp.
I'm not sure I'd like to
be
in that camp.
Any questions about the bill or the proposed amendment? Representative Krieger, if you would, please.
Chair, would I move to adopt the House Bill 2453-2 amendments dated 3-9-15.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2453 dated March 9th, 2015. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Krieger.
Chair Wood, I move House Bill 2453 2453 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Krieger moves House Bill 2453 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Moreno.
Aye.
Representative Huskell.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Forsyth.
Yes.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McClain.
Yes.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, the motion passes. Any volunteers to carry this bill to the floor?
Okay.
Representative Gorsuch, thank you much for that volunteering. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2453, and we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Committee members, I appreciate you. Thank you very much. Committee members, I appreciate